at a dinner party, attended by Pol Pot, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. Seated at another smaller table are Saddam Hussein, Slobodan Milosevic, Pinochet, and some others that I don't recognize. And then there's a third table, sort of a children's table. It has shorter legs and smaller children's chairs. And sitting there are Richard Speck, Gary Gilmore, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, Ted Bundy, and Charlie Manson. And they're all wearing party hats. They're not very much respected by the heavyweights. They were small time. They didn't get much done. They were pikers. And Pol Pot is talking about his tailor. He says he has the best tailor this side of Hong Kong. And he's debating with Hitler about whether pleated pants with a cuff brings out the stylishness of the wearer. Then the conversation veers off to wedding floral arrangements. Mao feels that a simple arrangement of bare grass and peonies suits the occasion. Whereas Hitler feels that lilies of the valley and acacia leaves mixed with cowrie shells, paper mache, and a cloisonné snuff bottle is elegant, exquisite, and understated. On the other hand, Pol Pot argues that American Beauty long-stemmed roses with baby's breath is the most perfect expression of nuptial bliss. Then we all get into a discussion concerning the selection of paint colors for the renovation of the kitchen. Hitler is partial to Bavarian cream, and Stalin interrupts, and he says he'd like to have a dacha effect with a checkered tablecloth, louvered shutters, gingham curtains. And then Pol Pot suggests little flower boxes for the windowsills, zinnias and daisies he thinks would be very cheerful. And then we talk about books. Hitler's favorite is Goodnight Moon. When the child comes home and says goodnight to everything in the room, goodnight door, goodnight ceiling, goodnight mother, goodnight father, and a tear comes to Hitler's eye, his lip quivers. Executioners are to be introduced and aided with the new technologies. God only knows what they will be capable of. And it's very exciting. I mean, with a small nuclear weapon, you can destroy an entire city in the twinkling of an eye. What a wondrous age we live in. And Pol Pot says, you know, we had to kill people with machetes and rifles. And now these young people have all the advantages. I mean, if we'd had what they have now, can you imagine what we could have accomplished? We were just born at the wrong time. Born too early. And we all indulge in a moment of nostalgia for the good old days. That anybody could come along and accomplish what Pol Pot did is still unlikely. The man was a transcendent genius. Or Hitler. Well, Hitler is God. He's the icon of his category. And I'm sitting there listening to this conversation, thinking, why am I here with all these heavyweights? What did I do?
No. active aortic valve, and it became infected, apparently. They don't know exactly when, but a few weeks ago, I started having symptoms. I saw doctors.
What were the symptoms you were having?
Shortness of breath, and also sort of general achiness from time to time. So I went to some doctors, and, eventually I got this test called an echocardiogram. I'd had a couple, and that's like a sound picture of your heart.
Hey, John, could you hold on 1 second?
Sure.
Be right back. Hello?
Joe, have you lost your mind? You are so funny. You asked me to look for rentals that were around 800 to 900.
I'm on a long-distance call right now.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
It's my fault. I shouldn't talk like that.
Well, maybe it's my fault.
But no, I just shouldn't. Okay.
Well, maybe it's your fault.
Yeah, okay. Bye-bye. Bye. Call me when you're done.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's
okay. I think you were talking about your symptoms and...
Yeah, I had some symptoms and I got some tests, and the short version is that they found this infection on the valve, which I guess is a fairly common problem if you have the mechanical defect that I have for it to become infected. So I was admitted to the hospital on an emergency basis, and they started pumping me full of intravenous antibiotics, and that was about a week ago, a little over a week ago, and they're going to continue that for another week or so. Then they're going to replace the valve. They're going to, you know, do surgery and put in the new valve.
And are you concerned, or?
I guess I'm as unconcerned as you can be before open heart surgery. Everything they tell me is that, my chances of full recovery are very high, especially given the fact that I'm fairly young and my heart and all of the other rest of my body is still working pretty well. You know, 100% recovery meaning, you know, that I would be restored to the state of health I was in basically before the valve started to leak. So that's about as good a prognosis as you can hope for. And I've also been told by a number of people that this is a fairly common procedure. I know that the surgeon who is going to be performing it has an extremely good reputation.
Do you feel it in any way that you've been changed by this experience, or that you're thinking in a new way, or thinking about things you haven't thought about before?
Well, oddly enough, not really. Although I would have thought I might. But I'm not really aware that I'm thinking about things all that differently, except that I am really looking forward to kind of getting back to my life. And I also, I guess, you know, there were points in this process when it wasn't so clear that I was going to be okay. And in fact, when I was first admitted, I was told that if I hadn't gotten to the hospital when I did, if I had, say, waited over the weekend, which I might have done because I didn't really feel that ill, that I might have died. You know, that the infection could have caused so much damage to the valve that I could have had heart failure, and if I wasn't at the hospital when it happened, I could have died. And that was a very frightening thought, and I guess that reminded me that I really want to live, and I really am looking forward to the possibilities of the rest of my life.
What will happen in this open-heart surgery?
The procedure?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. I think what they do is, of course, they make an incision, you know, like from your neck down to your navel, and then they open up your rib cage. And I don't know if they stop your heart or not. I'm planning to be asleep for this part of it. Then they, I guess they remove a piece of it, the area immediately surrounding the defective valve, which I guess is just outside the main body of the heart, or, you know, right at the kind of interface between the aorta and the main body of the heart. And then they put in another valve, which, if things go as planned, will be something made of human tissue. It's kind of a transplant. And
who's human tissue?
Some dead person who donated their body to medical use. Apparently, this procedure does not have problems with rejection. It doesn't have problems with infection. It's got a pretty good track record.
What kind of a support system do you have?
My family's around. At least a couple of them come by every day.
And your family consists of?
My parents, and I have two brothers and two sisters, all of whom live in the area. So, and two of my siblings are married, so their spouses have also come by, and kids have come by. And I also have been on the phone a lot to my friends in New York and Los Angeles. And in fact, I would say I spend about 3 hours a day on the phone talking to friends and, you know, describing what's going on and what the plan is and hearing them say how much they care about me and stuff like that. So I guess I don't foresee, death happening anytime soon. So, and I guess I'm lucky in that I don't obsess about it.
And what about any kind of religious faith? Or
I'm not really religious, and I don't believe in, a beautiful afterlife awaiting me or anything of that nature. My religious beliefs about death, I guess, are more or less that when a person dies, that's the end of any part of themselves that they would know as themselves. I mean, there may be some kind of spiritual energy that continues in some sense, but I think when the body dies, the ego goes with it, and it's not like you're going to be, sort of this ghostly presence in the living room, and you go to pick up the remote control, and your hand just goes right through it, and then you're, stuck watching the show that the rest of the people want to watch. I mean, I think, it's over. There is no after for the part of me that's talking to you right now. And that's the ultimate terrifying idea, I suppose. But again, since I'm not thinking that it's going to happen to me real soon, it doesn't upset me. If I didn't get this operation done, I would die fairly soon. I mean, if this was, a time before this operation was available, then I would be looking at dying fairly soon. But I'm not, which is quite an amazing thing. And I was told that the statistics are in the neighborhood of 98-99% chance of survival and recovery.
Do you have somebody that you're presently involved with?
Not really, no. I mean, I'm talking on the phone a lot with someone who, but we're not really, we don't really have any kind of definable status, except she's, a friend of mine, but that relationship has become very important to me. It was not something that just arose around this illness, but that's a big thing that I'm looking forward to, in a way. The prospects of where that relationship might go are, something that makes me happy and, something that makes me optimistic.
Has she been up to visit you? Or
no, she has not.
Why not?
Well, I think she will be. I think it was just a matter of the timing and her schedule and, the fact that nothing extremely urgent is going on with me.
How long have you been in the hospital now?
I have been in the hospital since, I guess it's 10 days.
Well, this is a little strange to me. I mean, it's almost like a little bit of a kind of freelance sadism. I mean, here's a guy minding his own business, no doubt confronting some major health issues in his life, and you come along, a friend of a friend, and you say a bunch of fairly innocuous things, but then you start sort of commenting or even, kind of rhetorical way, suggesting that what a terrible thing this woman must not care much for you.
Well, no, I didn't say that. No.
But, I mean, there was a hint of that. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing you did, but I can.
Well, no, you are saying that, aren't you? You are saying that.
I mean, yeah, I guess I am, sort of. No, I'm not really, because I'm not involved. It wasn't me.
No, but it's not a matter of whether you're involved or not.
But let me ask you this. Have you considered the possibility of getting in touch with this woman and finding out the, you know, again, telling her about the radio work that we do, that you do. And
you mean the woman who's dating him?
Who's dating him and has chosen not to come and visit him. Mm-hmm. And to try to involve her in this artistic endeavor. It's almost like a, you know, an audio documentary in a sense. But then if you could elicit from her a certain candid response to him, maybe it turns out that she's not that interested in him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as part of your own, I don't know if you think of yourself as kind of a provocateur in any way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, might you not call him and tell him that you've talked to this woman and she's really not planning to come to Boston, and while she wishes you the best, she's actually fallen in love with a cellist in the Baltimore Symphony. And how does that make you feel right now? That would probably be going too far, right?
Yeah, it's not much of a story, except that...
It would be a story if only you would become more seriously ill, and then we could talk later about it.
You know, you don't want this to be interesting. I mean, if you're in it. If you're me, you want this to be as dull as it can be. And quite frankly, if I was sicker and was really facing a significant possibility of dying or being disabled, I doubt I'd be talking to you. Because I just don't think I would be talking to a stranger about it.
Okay, so if things were to get worse, then we wouldn't be able to have a conversation.
Probably not, actually. I mean, no offense.
Oh, just one second. I have another call. I'll be right back. Hello?
Joe?
Yeah?
Are you on the line?
Mm-hmm.
When you call my house, listen to the machine. It'll give you a cell phone number. Call me on my cell.
Okay.
On Mike's cell. Bye.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah.
How do you feel about my disappointment and the fact that you're not more ill and that your situation is not more dire?
I feel a little sorry for you that, you know, this is your coping mechanism. But it seems to work for you, and you've integrated it into your life, and you've actually kind of created a job out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty cool. But I don't feel deeply sorry for you. I don't think there's any reason to. You know,
no.
You seem like you're okay. It's just, you know, it's a way of dealing with this part of you that you obviously identify with, which is, you know, some sort of morbidity or something.
Responding to feeling sorry for me, which had a patronizing, I feel sorry for you because you are so morally deficient that you would actually want someone to be more ill than they are just so you could get a good radio program out of it.
Well, I apologize.
Well, no, I don't apologize.
Because that's really not what I meant by that. I mean, I genuinely feel, it makes me sad when I think that ideas about death and dying seem to occupy as much of your life as they do. But
you don't even know me.
I know. Well, I'm just that kind of guy. I know you a little. We've had one conversation.
You said, I feel sorry for you.
Yes.
But I don't feel bad sorry for you. I want you to be honest with me. What was it that made you say that?
It wasn't a judgment on you. And what I was trying to explain a minute ago is I feel sorry for you in a compassionate sense.
But why?
I know that people use that expression now as an expression of contempt, the way people say, excuse me, when they mean get the fuck out of my way.
Yeah.
That's not the way I'm using it. I'm using it in its, you know, more traditional sense of I feel sad.
Because what was motivating that statement?
The fact that you call people up who are in the hospital and ask them about their illness and seem to be seeking some kind of answer to your own crisis about your mortality.
Is that really what you were thinking?
Yes.
What else could you have been thinking as well?
I was thinking that, you know, if I were your friend, I would not advocate your doing this.
Why wouldn't you?
Because I don't know that it's good for you, but I hasten to add that I didn't say that because I don't know you well enough, and I don't know, you know, that maybe this really does work for you, and maybe this is adaptive for you.
Maybe what works for me?
This, you know, this radio show and asking these questions and focusing on these issues. I think you're in a situation that feels to me, I guess maybe the word is unfortunate, because of what it is in you that makes you do it, or, you know, makes you seek this as, you know, the means of connecting with people and understanding yourself.
Do you know anything about my radio show?
No. I'm not judging you. You know, I'm really not judging you.
This is a total stranger, right?
Yeah.
In other words, you were almost laying on him that as much as I want you to get better, if you got worse, it would be better for my work.
And he said, I feel sorry for you. And then he said, but I don't feel that sorry for you. And I then...
pretty sick, this.
Yeah, right. So then I engaged him in this conversation about, well, why do you feel sorry for me? Oh, could you hold on 1 second?
Yeah.
I'll be right back. Hello?
Hi, Joe.
Hi, Ruth.
Listen, darling, I was listening to a tape. You'll know which one it is. I forgot.
Yeah.
On the treadmill this morning.
Yeah.
Joe, there's no way we can say suck my...
Actually, I don't remember which...
You don't?
No.
That's your mother crawling up a long corridor. It's supposedly...
That from the dream that I had. Oh, right, yeah.
There's just no way. I mean, you know, with suck my... doesn't seem to make any difference whether you say it. Well, of course, at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. But you can't say it at all. Graphic sex, Will tells me, is not permissible.
I understand. And I guess I shouldn't have. I thought because it was my mother saying something like that to me in
no,
a dream.
No, your mother saying it did anything makes it worse. I can't figure out how nobody in two broadcasts. You have so I mean, it's not that you have cowed your audience. It's simply that you've cowed everybody.
Well, I'll never do it again. Okay, that's all
okay,
I can say.
So you understand.
Yeah, I
good
do.
Good luck, PRI will never hear this.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, Ruth, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Hello?
It sounds to me like he was hearing from you the notion that if he had a heart attack... on the phone there, or maybe something less severe than a heart attack, some kind of episode, or whatever the cardiologists call an incident. If that happened while you were on the phone, then that might be very usable in this radio work, in this creative work that you were doing for the station, and probably a good thing for him. I don't know if you went that far to suggest to him that even if he was having a fatal heart attack, if he could... in some way just spend a few minutes recording what it was like to have a heart attack, even a fatal heart attack, that would be a great piece of radio. And it might be something that would justify his own existence and make... was he getting that from you again?
I think he was more angry than he was willing to acknowledge. In fact, I think his whole attitude was one of a kind of denial.
About what we were talking about before, it seems to me that the question this whole situation raises is what's allowable in the name of art. And in thinking about it, I really think that is an unanswerable question because it depends on who you're talking to. I mean, if you look at someone like Picasso, okay, Picasso made, you know, millions of paintings that people adore, and he made a lot of people rich. But if you look at his love life, his first wife, Olga Kakova, refused to ever give him a divorce and spent her whole life just obsessed with hating him.
His next significant relationship was Marie-Thérèse Voltaire. She committed suicide. His first grandson committed suicide. Then he got involved in a relationship with Dora Maar and sort of her career at that point. She was a good artist, too. Her career became very sort of unraveled, and she ended up in a mental hospital. And his last wife, Jacqueline Roque, committed suicide. And he was notorious for taking a huge toll on the people around him. You know, he wasn't a nice guy. Nobody's ever argued about that. But most people seem to agree that what he created was worth that human cost. But to me, that's impossible to quantify. I mean, if you took all those women who committed suicide and put them next to Guernica and said, okay, is this painting worth one tear shed by these women? Well, obviously, you'd probably say yes. Well, what, 1,000 tears? Yeah, probably. Well, how about one of their lives? Doubt. You know, it's like, where do you draw the line? You know, what is the acceptable cost for an artwork? I don't know. It's really impossible to say if the whole point of art is to elevate the human spirit. Then if you, you know, go down into the depths to make it, you're not doing that. But if everybody, I mean, there has to be an element of that, or we'd just have goody-goody art, which would be completely boring, and it wouldn't fully explore the human mind. I don't know. I'm just babbling. So you called this guy, you approached him in a neutral frame of mind. Then in talking to him, you discovered he really didn't elicit your empathy. Something in him generated something aggressive in you. Does that make it okay, then, to aggress against him? Well, that all depends, you know. If you made the most amazing radio show ever and it was the hit of your entire canon, we might consider that okay. But if the radio show turned out badly and it caused this guy great suffering, we'd probably say, well, it just wasn't worth it. These things are impossible to quantify. You know, it's like comparing toasters and oranges. An artwork, human suffering, their cruelty. I don't know, you and I have talked about this in different ways. I was working on a story I remember 2 months ago, and I had some information that I decided not to put into the story because I knew it would hurt the subject. You encouraged me to put it in because you said it would make it a better story. And perhaps you're right. Perhaps that makes me a less good journalist because I declined to do that. But the reverse of that is there have been stories in your life. I can think of 3 offhand that I said, why haven't you told that on your show? And you said, because it would hurt them. So you have bending rules there too, you know. You said that he annoyed you and that you wanted to crack his facade and reach him, but sometimes facades and masks are very, you know, fragile, precarious things that people keep in place just barely, and to rip that away from them is not a very kind thing to do. It's interesting, though, that I got the impression that the conversation with him really took on some energy when you did cross that line. You did succeed in reaching him. The whole tone of the conversation changed. You're not a bad person, Joe. I think that you have so trained yourself to sort of ruthlessly reveal and use whatever is in your life, in your work, that, you know, that's the subject of the show this week, even though I think you're a little ashamed of this whole thing.
Well, you're being ruthless. I mean, again, it's with a stranger. I mean, if I was having a situation like that, I mean, I was told today by a dermatologist that I might have a little smidge of skin cancer.
Really?
Yeah, but it didn't bother me a bit. I mean, because it just didn't, it seemed like such a minor thing. That's such a common thing, you know, that people have these little things. And he made it, he was very jovial about it. And I thought about it a few times today. I said, isn't that interesting? I don't care. And it doesn't make me feel at all vulnerable or unwell.
Well, it depends on what it is. If it's a melanoma.
No, I'll be the serious thing. He made it sound like it wasn't very serious.
Oh, well, then.
The kind of thing that people get for going in the sun too much, which is pretty common among white males.
Yeah, but some people die of those things.
From one little thing?
if it is a melanoma, it's something that through the skin has actually entered your body.
It
spreads throughout your system, and then people die of skin cancer.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, it's very common. I think it's
from a little tiny thing, like smaller than a dime.
Mm-hmm.
It could infiltrate your whole system.
Did he say he's going to take it to a laboratory and biopsy?
Yeah, a little biopsy.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have the results yet of what?
No. But
did he say anything about radiation or?
No, nothing like that.
Chemotherapy or?
Oh no, I don't think he regarded it as something that had to be treated beyond its removal.
He didn't mention hospice.
No, nothing like that. He made it sound like a very common thing. He said, in fact, he's kind of a witty guy.
Mm-hmm.
I never met this guy before. I'm glad, nice Park Avenue dermatologist that I got through my health plan through SAG.
So there are vows that are taken in certain Buddhist centers. Every day they're chanted, the Bodhisattva vows. Beings in the universe are numberless. I vow to liberate them all. Dharmas are infinite, all the teachings. I vow to master them all. Obstacles are endless. That one you know very well. I vow to overcome them all. And the Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. These impossible things, beings are numberless, I'm going to save them all. And really what these vows are is simply a direction of the heart. That even if the sun comes up in the west, the Bodhisattva, the being committed to compassion and liberation, has only one way. No matter how the world turns or changes, I still vow to stay true to awakening, to respect, to compassion in any circumstance. So this quality of dedication isn't gaining or wanting something to happen. It's rather the direction of our heart that says, this is what I value and I will live this. Life shrinks or expands according to one's courage. It's amazing, when we commit ourselves to something, everything in us changes. Our cells somehow get the message and realign. And often, karma, providence, whatever you want to call it, changes as well. You begin to do something and you really believe it, and things start to move with us. They follow that energy, they follow our heart. Now, one of the really lovely practices in this tradition of meditation is the practice of metta, or loving kindness meditation. Part of the way that the formal practice of loving kindness is done is that one sits or walks and uses a series of phrases which give voice to the intention of the heart. Wishing well for oneself, a loved one, a benefactor, and so forth. So you begin with a simple phrase, if it were for yourself, loving kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful. May I be filled with loving kindness. Or may I have well-being, body and heart and mind. Or you might wish that for another person. You picture this person you love. May they be well. May they be filled with loving kindness. It's as if setting that as the direction of the heart creates it. Rumi puts it this way. He says, love everyone. Start a large, useless project like Noah. It doesn't matter. Just do it from your heart. The power of intention or commitment to what we value is extraordinary. Doing it again and again, and it grows. It's the seed we plant and the watering of it and the nurturing, and it grows for us. It's really moment by moment. It's not a big thing, this dedication. It's a dedication this moment to be present, this moment of compassion. And then it is the journey itself, not the goal, but the journey that becomes beautiful. The journey done for its own sake.
Hitler saw his entire project as some grandly beautiful artwork. He thought he was creating something beautiful. And so he gave himself permission to do the atrocious things he did. He saw himself as an artist and a great creator. He was a failed visual artist. And this was his massive sculpture. He was re-sculpting Europe. I don't think that any of the great dictators of the 20th century, Mao, Pol Pot, Stalin, I don't think any of them saw what they were doing as evil. I can't, Papa Doc Duvalier, Idi Amin, these people are, you know, they're insane, basically. I don't think they knew they were doing wrong. I think they were convinced they were doing right. You know, it takes like a streak of messianic thinking. Yeah, it's very grandiose doing wrong. So, yeah, they all thought they were saving their country, changing the world, purifying the race, you know, freeing the slaves, who knows. But I don't think they thought they were doing wrong. I mean, I couldn't think of any of them have ever, you know, wept and I remember Pol Pot gave some just incredibly innocuous comment to the press. Basically, you know, writing, you know, dismissing the killing fields with just a wave of the hand. It was just, you know, it was a minor thing blown up in the newspaper, no big deal. Yeah. The people who tend to be afflicted with guilt are not the big criminals. In fact, you know, I go to a class with this rabbi who counsels people, and he said that most of the people who come in there just racked with guilt. He said people are guilty over the most minor things. You know, good people feel guilt. Bad people don't. Bad people are too busy doing bad things to reflect.
I was walking down a country road somewhere in Tunisia, or possibly Morocco. I'm not really sure. There was a mountainous region off to the left, which suggested the Cordillera that runs down the spine of South America through Ecuador and Peru. Well, it really doesn't matter where it was. I was there. It was a dream. And as I walked along, I approached a large mud brick structure, perhaps 3-4 stories tall. The walls themselves of adobe brick were weathered by age. So the gate opened, slowly, with a great clanking of chains and a grinding and protesting of wooden and ironclad gears. And as soon as I entered, the ambience changed dramatically. For what was within the walls was a great, vast, treeless desert stretching beyond the horizon to a distant point against which the sky melted evenly with the sands. And there, inside, I found myself in a garden setting where birds were singing and perfumed fountains flowed and beautiful maidens offered trays of sweetmeats and fruits. I was in an oasis in the desert. And I had come there in order to speak with God. I wanted to ask him the questions that many of us ponder. Idea was it for the word lisp to have an S in it? And if one synchronized swimmer drowns, do the rest drown too? And is there another word for synonym? And if the police arrest a mime, do they tell him he has the right to remain silent? Actually, what had brought me this great distance to meet God was my obsession with watching National Geographic Wild Kingdom specials on television, in which we see the hierarchy of predators. Lions stalking their prey, moving silently through the tall grass, and then chasing and bringing down a gazelle. One lion holding in its jaws the dying animal by the throat, while another is disemboweling it. And you see the wild, desperate look on the face of the gazelle, suffocating, being devoured. Or a zebra crossing a river, and a crocodile launching itself out of the water and clamping the hapless zebra in its huge jaws. The zebra dragged into the water, screaming, and then drowned and eaten by the crocodile. And then there's the python falling from the tree, quickly wrapping itself around the wild boar in the embrace of death. Every time the boar breathes out, the snake contracts, squeezing it until the boar can no longer breathe in, asphyxiating. I watch television, read books, listen to classical music, entertain guests, hang pictures on the wall, put expensive Persian rugs on the floor. I bathe, cook, make love to my girlfriend, while at the very same time, underneath the very house I live in, there is a dark, sunless world of insects and microbial life, hunting and eating each other. The living beings in the soil beneath my house are disemboweling even smaller creatures who seek even smaller prey with voracious abandon. And when I replace a light bulb in my garden, I go outside and I reach up to unscrew the dead bulb, and my hand passes through a spider web, and there are maybe 20 different little flies and moths that have been trapped and killed and sucked dry by the spider. Say to God, you created the universe. You created this whole system of survival of the fittest, this hierarchy of murder. And how am I supposed to go to church or to synagogue and worship and pray to you and talk about the perfection of your creation and the beauty of all your works? And yet here I see them as a vast and hopeless display of violence and death from which there is, for the creatures involved, no escape. I want to love you, to give myself over to you, to find solace in you, and comfort in you. But I keep turning on the National Geographic specials on the Discovery Channel, and frankly, it's very disturbing. So, in my dream, God is sitting there, in a canvas director's chair, by the water. He's got a single diamond stud in his left earlobe. And he's wearing a pair of drawn-at-the-waist with a rope sash, linen pants by Hermes. His feet in a pair of gorgeous Italian sandals. His eyes hidden behind a very expensive pair of Oakley sunglasses made of titanium. And he's sipping from a cool glass of Perrier Jouet. But before I can speak, he reaches forward and draws a pack of cards from behind my ear, along with a gold coin and a ping pong paddle. And I realize I don't like this dream anymore. Wishing myself elsewhere, I find myself in a nightclub somewhere in Prague. The room is blue and heavy, with the scent of cigarette smoke, fragrant and rich. There's a Eurotrash rock band, all spiky hair and glittered tights and lightning bolts painted onto their faces. Men and women, impossibly thin, playing long-necked guitars, screaming and screeching into a microphone. The lead girl singer, sunken-eyed and gorgeous, her narrow body undulating to the sound of the music. She seems somehow to be pulled by a string attached to her from the bass player's left hand, her pelvis gyrating back and forth. There's an air of decadence, and the place feels as though it's on the eve of some catastrophe. And on a swing is a young girl, pigtailed, wearing patent leather shoes and a party dress, and she's swinging out up over the audience and then back above the stage, throwing chrysanthemum petals into the audience from a large wicker basket that she holds. And people are writhing and thrashing about on the dance floor. Some of them appear almost reptilian, moving against one another as though they're snakes or lizards. Others move with staccato gestures, almost as if saluting an unseen point on the horizon. Yet others, like marathon dancers, are slumped one against the other, shuffling listlessly on the floor. And the great mirrored ball that hangs, rotating slowly from the ceiling, is projecting images of swastikas and death heads against the walls of the room. I'm sitting at a table by the stage when I notice, under the next table, a tombstone. And I realize that this nightclub has been built over a graveyard. I can see inscriptions on tombstones in Hebrew and the edge of a decayed mausoleum pushing its way up through the floor, which is being used as the bar. And I'm just getting as drunk as I possibly can. When I see a number of tables occupied by priests in dark suits, clerical collars, their hair slicked back. Some are handling rosary beads, others toying listlessly with votive cups, others touching the foreheads of passers-by with holy water, some reading from scripture. An individual dressed as the Pope, wearing the papal garments, the mitre, and holding the staff and the shepherd's crook, stands behind the bar, drinking from a bottle of 151-proof Puerto Rican rum. And I'm thinking, what am I doing in this dream? What am I doing in this club? I shouldn't be here. And summoning my strength, I rise from the table and drunkenly stumble out into the cool night air.
Lord, I'll never.
I'm standing outside, and the cobblestone streets are narrow. The buildings leaning in toward one another. The shops boarded up for the night. And from every lamppost is hanging a body. And then I pass a huge pit, and it's filled with the cadavers of the schoolteacher, the shoemaker, the head of the local labor council, an electrician, and hundreds of others. And then I see a revisionist historian. He's standing on a wooden crate, speaking into a megaphone. And he's saying, "These are not corpses. These are, in fact, mock-up dolls created by clever Jewish artisans who would fool the eye and befoul the senses. Come, take a closer look. See how they're created out of wax and wool. See how this is made of limestone and linen." And so I say, all Jews must be driven from their homes and their businesses closed, and they must be gathered into extermination camps and murdered because of this outrageous fiction they have perpetrated on us. Yes, if they claim that such a thing happened, well then, let it happen. If they wish that upon themselves, let it be. If that's what they want, then it is our duty to give it to them. We owe them nothing less. And there's a crowd of people gathered around the speaker. They hang on his every word, except when they burst into wild, uncontrollable cheering. The crowd holds burning torches and rude implements of farm tools. One man even has a bullwhip. And some of the men hold young children on their shoulders. And the children, with balled fists, are gesturing menacingly against the light of the fire, exhorting the speaker to greater heights of passion. I listen, terrified and angry, but I know that if I speak up, I will be crushed by them. Eventually, the screaming orator, the fiery torches, and the cheers recede into the distance, until at last all I can hear is the quiet sounds of the night, the birds and the crickets, the rushing of the river, the sound of the wind rustling the leaves in the trees. And then I see a pair of headlights coming up the road. And the first thing I think of is jumping into the ditch. But then, somehow, inexplicably, I find myself waving with my hand, urging the driver to stop. And the car passes me, and then I see the brake lights flare, and the car stops. And I run up and open the door, and I look in, and there's my mother, and my father, and a small boy. Me. We're on our way to our country house. And my parents are younger than I am. And they gesture for me to climb in. And I say, "No, I will continue walking." And they shrug. And my father gives me a doubtful look. And then the car drives off into the distance until I see it stop at a military checkpoint, where there are soldiers, and I hear raised voices. The car doors slam, and then I hear distinct individual pistol shots, and a shriek, and some more shots, and then the sounds of shovels, of earth being broken, and the barked orders of a sergeant. And up in the sky, I see three shooting stars fall to Earth. And then I wake up, drag myself out of bed, get dressed, drive down to Seattle Coffee, and get a cafe latte, three spoons of sugar, buy an LA Times, sit down at a table by the window, and read about my own suicide.
To Joe Frank, The Other Side. This program was called Bad Karma, with Larry Block, Christine McKenna, Jack Kornfield, and Joe Frank. Special thanks to John. Portions created in collaboration with David Rapkin. This program was recorded and edited by J.C. Swadek and mixed by Bob Carlson. Music consultant Thomas Gulovich. Production assistants Esme Gregson. To order cassettes of Jack Kornfield's lectures on Buddhism, call Sounds True Audio at 1-800-333-9185.